The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists annual convention and scientific sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the annual clinical assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Emerging Treatment of Diabetes is presented by Dr. Gregory Barone.
So today's topic, let's go back one. He asked me to talk about emerging treatments of diabetes, and mainly we'll focus on type 2 diabetes. Although up front I will tell you that the most exciting advances in the management of diabetes are really more in the field of type 1 diabetes, and I'll tease this out that in a couple of hours you'll get a chance to hear a lot about this from Dr. Shore when he presents insulin pumps and glucose monitors. In terms of type 2 diabetes, there's been an explosion of medications and drug classes, and you know, if you do endocrinology, if you do diabetes management on a regular basis, you start to get to know this stuff secondhand. But if you're a practicing internist or you're a subspecialist, I could certainly understand how this could be a little overwhelming. A few disclosures up front. You could see I'm an equal opportunity speaker, so if you have product and a lot of money, I'm happy to do it for you. Quick aside, as an undergraduate, I was an economics minor, and my first day of microeconomics 101, I was in a class size about this big, about this filled, too. Everybody sat in the back. And our microeconomics professor, who happened to be the chair of the department, started the first day of lecture by introducing himself in microeconomics, and he said that his goal was to make economics as confusing and confounding as possible, thereby causing half of us to quit his class, keeping the supply of economists down, keeping him in high demand. I don't introduce that to say that I'm going to try to confuse the heck out of you for the next 40, 45 minutes. I just like to point out that as an endocrinologist, because of diabetes, we are in high demand. And the problem is there's so many patients, there's so many people walking around with diabetes. This data here is a couple of years old by now. You see 29, probably closer to 30 million patients with diabetes. And a scary number is 25% don't even know that they have diabetes. If you include patients who have pre-diabetes, you're talking about another 89, 90 million patients. Even with all the attention that the healthcare system has thrown towards diabetes, there's still 27% of the population over the age of 65 gets diagnosed, and over a million new cases per year. So it is, on some level, an epidemic, and it closely mirrors the obesity epidemic. If you go back to the 1970s, 1980s, and you track obesity rates through into the 2000s, and you track diabetes rates through into the 2000s, you see that the two curves go hand in hand. And this is not anything new to anybody that's in this room. It's the American lifestyle, the ease with which you can supersize your meals, the conveniences that we have at our disposal. It creates an environment in which the average Joe or the average Jane is unfortunately struggling with weight, struggling with metabolic syndrome, struggling with diabetes, and unfortunately a lot of the complications that go along with that. Now, we can't talk about diabetes in 2017 without showing this slide. I think it's actually mandatory now. This concept was introduced some 8 years ago by Ralph DeFranza, who is a very famous diabetologist at the University of Texas. And he introduced this concept at the annual ADA conference as part of his Banting lecture. And prior to this, and I would imagine that for the majority of the people sitting in this room, when you learned or you were taught type 2 diabetes, you really highlighted three primary concepts. And we knew that there was, on some level, failure of the pancreas to meet the body's demands, so that we have beta cell dysfunction. Type 2 diabetes was differentiated very clearly from type 1 diabetes by the presence of insulin resistance, depicted up here as the decreased glucose uptake. And we also knew that the liver was an active player. We had patients who would go to bed with a blood sugar of 140 and wake up the next morning with a blood sugar of 180 and scratch their heads and say, we don't understand why. But out of that original triumph, science has really started to identify that this disease is a lot more involved than even that basic understanding. And over time, different factors have been identified, which have also allowed for different therapeutic modalities. And this, as you can see, goes back to 2009. Dr. DeFranzo and another endocrinologist at the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Stanley Schwartz, have gotten themselves into a little bit of an arms race. Dr. Schwartz, a couple of years ago, published a paper on the egregious 11. And then I think DeFranzo was up to 12 or 13. There might even be up to 14 new defects now, all leading to this chronic hyperglycemia. And we're going to highlight a couple of them, and that'll hopefully in turn lead us into some pointed discussion with some of the newer therapies and newer modalities that are out there that can certainly help your patients with type 2 diabetes. This remains the hallmark, though: insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome. We all know it when we see it, but it's not necessarily always so easy to explain. It is a complicated syndrome. There's certainly a genetic component. You know, if you look at all patients who develop type 2 diabetes, there's a very high preponderance within the family. So there's usually some genetic predisposition that is inherited. And then you add on top of that, like I said, the American lifestyle. People don't exercise. We eat crappy. You go for convenience. For an extra 25 or 35 cents, you can supersize that meal. You can get the extra fries thrown in. You can get the larger soda. And as a result of those two factors coming together, you have patients who first start to gain a lot of weight. Body tries to compensate. For a while, they might have normal or at least near normal blood sugars. You might start to see some lipid abnormalities, HDL levels start to drop, triglyceride levels start to go up, and then they get to that threshold point, and now you have a patient with type 2 diabetes. And really, that threshold point is when that pancreatic function starts to dip. I think we've all seen a slide like this or something similar. At the bottom, you have the natural history of type 2 diabetes. And the yellow line is a marker of your insulin resistance. That dashed line is the point at which type 2 diabetes is diagnosed, whether it's your two fasting blood sugars of 126, whether it's your A1C of 6.5%, whatever the marker is that you're using. But you could see the disease is present for years before that, 15, 20 years at some points. And what is happening is the body is becoming resistant to insulin, but for many years it's able to compensate, and that's what you're seeing in the red line. Insulin production is going up, and as long as those two curves move in unison, blood sugars are going to be relatively flat, relatively stable, and you see that at the top. But at some point, the pancreas is going to say, we can't do the job anymore, and insulin production is going to go down. And as soon as that happens, blood sugars are going to start to rise, and now you have a patient with diabetes. So a lot of what we try to do clinically is to identify earlier and then choose medications, drugs, drug classes, therapies that are going to try to reverse this natural course of diabetes. This data goes back in the 1990s. The estimate, again, about a third to half of pancreatic function is lost at the time of diagnosis. And again, depending upon what treatments you offer your patients, there's the potential that beta cell failure will continue on. I say to my patients, you know, with type 2 diabetes, if you live long enough, you're going to end up on insulin. You know, a lot of patients have a misperception that when they end up on insulin, they're now type 1. They're not. They're type 2. But as the disease goes on, and as patients are identified earlier and earlier in the disease process, you're going to find more and more patients with type 2 diabetes that do ultimately require insulin. The role of the fat cell as part of the disease process, decreasing glucose uptake, has its own ramifications with the release of free fatty acids, which stimulates gluconeogenesis, further impairs insulin release, stimulates glucagon release, again, contributing to this chronic hyperglycemia. So we take that ominous octet, as Dr. DeFranzo coined it, and what you have here is a number of different therapeutic classes that are targets for all of those different defects. So if we go to the old standby, and I'm not going to go through all the different drug classes, that could be a whole session in and of itself. But if you go to the old standby metformin, even if we don't know the exact mechanism, we know that eventually what it does is it's going to suppress hepatic glucose production. So it's one of your best drugs for that purpose. It has a little bit of insulin sensitizing effects. You can see it's also listed there under the insulin resistance. TZDs, we know that that's your most potent drug class to improve insulin resistance. We've identified neurotransmitter dysfunction. We've come up with products such as GLP-1 receptor agonist, pramlintide, and even bromocriptine that are working specifically within the brain to help with hyperglycemia. Sulfonylureas directly stimulate the release of insulin. Obviously, you can provide insulin, DPP-4 inhibitors, GLP-1 receptor agonist, and then the kidney, which is now the target of your sodium glucose transport inhibitors. To me, this is an important slide in understanding how to manage your patient with type 2 diabetes, because one of the goals should be to try to individualize your therapy while also trying to cover multiple defects. In other words, it doesn't make a lot of sense to give a patient sulfonylurea and then to give them a secretagogue on top of that. You're doing the same thing. Just like it doesn't make a lot of sense to give them a DPP-4 inhibitor and a GLP-1 receptor agonist. They're doing the same thing. So you want to try to cover bases and have your medications that are going to work in a synergistic fashion for you. How low to go? This is still up for debate, depending upon your whether you're a follower of the ADA, which still recommends an A1C less than 7%. American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, like a little bit stricter, they'll say 6.5%. And that all stems back from the DCCT trial, which looked at patients with type 1 diabetes back in the 1990s. And really what they saw was that there's a pretty consistent reduction in microvascular complications as average blood sugars improved, but that curve was not necessarily linear. And it really starts to flatten out right around 7%. So to say it differently, once you get below 7%, the degree of further risk reduction really starts to be minimized, but now you might be introducing more opportunities for hypoglycemia, particularly in a population of type 1. So if you ever wondered where the A1C target comes from, it comes from this study going back to the 1990s. The ADA has issued an algorithm a year, I think, now for the last 4 or 5 years, and one of the things that I always get asked is, well, what A1C do you use? The easy answer, as it is with most things in diabetes, is it depends. It depends upon your patient. And finally, the algorithms have caught up to real world, because you can't treat every patient with type 2 diabetes the same way. And because of that, this is not a disease that really lends itself to an algorithm in the classical way you think of an algorithm. If a patient presents with community-acquired pneumonia and they're going to the floor, they get this antibiotic. If they come in and they go to the ICU, they get these antibiotics. If they come from a healthcare facility, they get this. Well, you can't say if a type 2 diabetic with insurance under the age of 50 comes in, they get these two drugs, and if they're 66 and on Medicare, they get these two drugs. It's just not a disease that really lends itself to that. So there is a lot of individualization that needs to take place when meeting with these patients. And that's what is highlighted here. And there's a number of factors that are just historical facts about your patient. For example, if they've had diabetes for 45 years, that you're going to probably have to manage them differently than somebody who's had diabetes for 5 months. If somebody's in their 80s and they have multiple risk factors, cardiovascular disease, I'm not really concerned if they get retinopathy 5 years from now. But if I have a patient who's 32, just diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, I'm very concerned about microvascular disease over the next 15, 20, 25, or more years. The two at the bottom we do have a little bit more influence on, and I think probably more worthy of our attention in discussions when we meet with patients in the office, and that's what's your patient's attitude towards the treatment. If you've got that patient who you're lucky you see them every 12 months and the only reason they're coming in is because you know they need their refill, that's probably not an ideal candidate to push their A1C to 6.5. But if you've got somebody who comes in and they have their spouse at every visit and they come in every 3 months and they always get their blood work and they always do what they're supposed to do and they never miss their appointment, that's somebody you could potentially feel a little bit more comfortable targeting a little bit more intensive therapy. And the last one I think is very important too, and that's resources and support system. If you have somebody who lives alone and maybe once a week they have a neighbor that checks in on them, if you target too low and they get an episode of hypoglycemia, that's potentially catastrophic. But if you have somebody who lives in a household with 3 or 4 people and he has people constantly checking on him, if something were to happen, you do feel a little bit more comfortable. And all of these factors should play a role in determining how low you really want to go with your A1C target. And this is, again, for lack of a better word, what we put out there is the algorithms, comes from the ADA. And really the only thing that diabetologists would agree on is diet, exercise, and metformin. And then beyond that, you kind of pick your poison. And the ADA lists 5 things to consider when choosing your next agent. Because we know, very few of your patients are going to get to where they need to be with just diet, exercise, and metformin. So you're going to run into a decision where you have to add a second drug, a third drug, a fourth drug. And the 5 things that they would consider is efficacy in terms of A1C reduction. The reality is all of these drugs work. They wouldn't be available if they didn't. But sometimes you need something that's going to have a little more potency, and we're going to highlight some of that in a little bit. Consideration should be given to hypoglycemia. More and more studies now are starting to highlight some of the risks that come along with episodes of hypoglycemia. And it's recommended not only by the ADA, but also by the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists to try to minimize hypoglycemic risk whenever you can. We know that 85 to 90% of patients with type 2 diabetes are overweight or obese. We spend a lot of our time at the visits harping on the need for diet and exercise and weight reduction. And for 15 to 20 years, every medication except for metformin that we offered them caused weight gain. So you can see how that would be frustrating for patients when they would come back time and time again. Hey, you're 3 pounds up from last time. I told you, you really got to crack down and you got to lose 3 pounds, three more pounds next time. So if you have an opportunity to offer medication, which is either weight neutral or can maybe even encourage some of these patients to lose weight, obviously that is advantageous for your patients. Obviously, you need to consider side effects, potential contraindications. Again, individualized to your patient. If you have a patient who has congestive heart failure, a TZD is not your best choice. If you have a patient who's had chronic pancreatitis, a GLP-1 receptor agonist is not your best choice. And as much as we would love to ignore the elephant in the room, we can't. Cost has to be a concern. It might be great if we could throw all of these $1,000 a month drugs at our patients, but we know that there's going to be opportunities where that's just not financially feasible. But using those 5 factors, we try to determine what we think is best for the patient, have that educated discussion. They're going to come back 3 months later, 6 months later. If they're still not where they need to be, now you reshuffle the deck and you do it all over again. Triple therapy, quadruple therapy, referral to your local endocrinologist. So again, we're going to highlight just a couple of these drug classes, some of the newer modalities, things that you might not be as familiar with. I'm going to start in the kidney. This is really a unique way to manage diabetes. For a lot of the people in this room, again, when you learn diabetes, the concept of sugar in the urine was a bad concept, right? That's an indication of disease to the kidney. That's an indication of bad blood sugar. Well, it turns out that the kidney is capable of filtering about 180 grams of glucose every day. And the vast majority of that is going to be reabsorbed within the proximal convoluted tubule. And that's going to go through a very specific channel, a sodium glucose co-transporter. 2, and the remaining 10% is going to be in the distal segment through the SGLT1 receptor. If everything works in unison, if everything is working physiologically, all of the sugar that's in the blood will be filtered, all of the sugar is going to be reabsorbed, and there should be no glucose in the urine. The body has a funny way of adapting. So if you have a patient who has now developed chronic hyperglycemia, they're seeing a lot more sugar that's being filtered because there's a lot more sugar in the blood. So the kidney compensates, and it increases the density and the number of SGLT2 receptors. So if you have more receptors, you actually increase the threshold for reabsorption. And so patients with type 2 diabetes might be able to reabsorb 220 grams of sugar a day or more. Counterintuitive, right? Blood sugars are already high. Why is the kidney driving those blood sugars higher? But that's one of the disease processes that Dr. DeFranza was highlighting in his Omnis Octet. And if we zoom in on the tubule cells, to the left you have the lumen, and you can see that's where the glucose is going to be freely filtered. The SGLT2 is a co-transporter, so glucose and sodium get pumped into the cell. The glucose will then pass through GLUT2 on the basement side and go right back into the bloodstream. Sodium gets exchanged for a potassium and an ATPase. So the end result of this is, of course, glucose going from the collecting system where it's been filtered back into the bloodstream where, unfortunately, we don't necessarily want it or need it. But you can imagine pharmacologically, if you take a medication that blocks that SGLT2, that glucose, which has been filtered, is going to stay within the lumen. It can't get back into the bloodstream, and it's going to get flushed down the toilet. And so what ends up happening is you have almost an osmotic diuretic effect. If you go back to the classic symptoms of type 2 diabetes, it's uncontrolled polyuria, polydipsia. A lot of these patients will experience that on a lower grade, but they'll probably see their urinary frequency go up. They might see an increase in their thirst. And as long as you educate patients to maintain adequate hydration, they can usually manage any volume changes that are thrown their way. There are downsides. If you're passing more sugar through the urinary tract system, that could be a bed for infection, particularly UTIs and yeast infections. And to some extent, you do need kidneys that work. We know that there's a high prevalence of chronic kidney disease in patients with long-standing type 2 diabetes. These medications are not necessarily nephrotoxic, but if your filtration is very low, you're not going to have a very effective medication. But these can be quite beneficial to your patients. They're going to carry a very low risk for hypoglycemia unless they're used with another agent like insulin or sulfonylurea. As you're excreting glucose on some level, you're excreting calories every day, and so these are patients who can sometimes see sufficient weight reduction. Because of the osmotic effect, sometimes you could see a 3 to 5 or 6 millimeter mercury blood pressure. Its effects are really limited to the kidneys, so this isn't anything that usually carries a lot of systemic side effects. And we're going to highlight some of this potential cardiovascular benefit. There are 3 medications in class, the glifosins, canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, and empagliflozin. And Jardiance made its claim to fame with the first large-scale cardiovascular outcome-driven study that showed a specific benefit to a specific medication. And this, we're not going to go through the entirety of the study. This one study could be an hour lecture in and of itself. But just as a broad overview, these are patients with type 2 diabetes, uncontrolled, at least 18, and everybody had established cardiovascular disease. 3 arms to the study. There's an EMPA-10, an EMPA-25, and then a placebo arm, looking at a primary outcome, a composite of death from cardiovascular causes, non-fatal MI, or non-fatal stroke, and you can see there 7,000 patients and about a 3-year follow-up. And what you see is a substantial improvement. Top left, if you look at the primary outcome, which is the composite of all-cause mortality, or mortality from cardiovascular causes, I should say, you can see the lines diverge fairly early on, less than 6 months. Usually, I think they saw it as early as 12 weeks. And you can see that maintained out through the end of the study. And if you look specifically top right, death from cardiovascular causes, again, you see changes that favor empagliflozin. Death from any cause, you see the same thing on the bottom left. And potentially what is explaining a lot of this is the improvements related to heart failure. And you see the hospitalizations from heart failure on the bottom right. And again, this is just a breakdown. You see at the top, death from cardiovascular causes. You see the p-value all the way to the right. Death from cardiovascular causes, including non-fatal MI, non-fatal risk, again, you see the p-value there. Death from any cause, you see the p-value. Death from cardiovascular cause, you can see that there. So a lot of this seems to be driven, if you look, break it down by event, by a reduction in congestive heart failure, but that doesn't necessarily explain all the differences between the groups. And we have other medications that are potent diuretics that have not necessarily substantiated this. But on the basis of this clinical study, Jardiance was the first medication that received a dual indication for treating both type 2 diabetes and patients with established cardiovascular disease. More recently, canagliflozin was involved in a large-scale trial that was similar in design. It was called CANVAS. Similar population of patients that were studied. Again, adults over the age of 18, you can see the A1C range. Two different qualifications to get into the study: age greater than 30 with atherosclerotic disease, or age greater than 50 with at least two risk factors. And these are defined here. So anybody with diabetes of at least 10 years, blood pressure over 140 over 90, microalbuminuria, or an HDL level that was less than 38. Again, three arms to the study: low dose, high dose, and a placebo, looking at a very similar primary outcome of death from CV causes: non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke. A little larger study, almost 10,000 patients, and about a 3.5-year follow-up study. And you can see here, if you look at the very top, that's your death from cardiovascular causes. That line stays to the left, so that hazard ratio favors canagliflozin, and that is a statistically significant. You can see individual subsets of that do cross the line, so there is no statistical significance for death from cerebrovascular, non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke. But if you go all the way down to the bottom, you'll see that the death from cardiovascular causes or hospitalization from congestive heart failure and hospitalization for heart failure, those are the two factors that are really driving the data in the favor of canagliflozin. Again, on some level you expect that. It's a medication that's going to have some blood pressure reduction and some diuretic effect. So a similar finding to what we see in the EMPA-REG study. Looking at your Kaplan-Meier curves, again, you see a relatively early separation of the curves when it comes to death from cardiovascular causes, and you see that also more pronounced for the hospitalization for congestive heart failure. And you see that top left, and you see that bottom right, which is a composite of the heart failure and death. What probably got your attention in your clinic was what's circled here, and that's the amputation rates. If you tease out those numbers, these are peripheral amputations in the feet, and the rates are relatively low, but they are different. And it was about twice as high in the group that received canagliflozin relative to the group that received placebo. These rates are expressed in per 1,000 patient years. And the majority of these came in patients who had established peripheral arterial disease or prior amputation. So I think on some level you have to be smart about where you're prescribing these medications. The one thing that I always harp on with my residents and with the fellows is you have to understand the population of the patients being studied. There are subtle differences between the populations. It's not the same group that was studied. And it's not necessarily something that you can apply to the drug class across the board. The rest of the side effects are fairly in line with what we know about this drug class: higher rates of UTI, higher rates of genital yeast infections. This was a very interesting study. This was published in Circulation. It's called the CVD REAL. Okay, this is not a prospective study. This is a retrospective analysis of real-world data. So they used a large American database, they used a number of different European databases, and what they started with was about 1 million patients who were prescribed a new oral medication for type 2 diabetes. And of that, 166,000 received an SGLT2, the other 1.2 million received some other oral glucose-lowering drug. So then they tried to match the population that received an SGLT2 as closely with a comparable number of patients who received another agent. Okay, so that's why 1 million of the oral glucose patients were excluded. They want a comparable number, and they wanted the parameters of those that were selected for an SGLT2 to mirror the patient factors in the other class. And there's a number of different charts and manifestations of how the statisticians ran it, but the end result was that those who received an SGLT2 inhibitor versus an alternative oral glucose agent consistently seemed to have a lower risk of hospitalization for heart failure and a lower risk for death. So this starts to lend a little bit of real-world evidence behind the CANVAS and the EMPA-REG studies that we just showed you. Dapagliflozin is currently undergoing the DECLARE study, which we anticipate being published sometime in 2019, which is their own cardiovascular outcome-driven study. Switching from the kidney now to the gut, we're going to talk about the incretin effect in the incretin class. And just very quickly, this is a picture of that effect. You can see to the left, this is a series, I think it's only about 12 or 15 patients who are considered healthy. And what happens is they hook up an IV, they infuse dextrose, and they raise blood sugars to a certain level, and they measure insulin production. The insulin production is depicted there in the red line. You can see, as you would expect, as blood sugars go up, the pancreas compensates, releases a little bit of insulin, sugars come down, insulin levels drop with it. Same patients are now fed. They're basically given an oral glucola challenge. And the same thing, measure the insulin response. So the levels of glucose in the blood are similar in both studies, but you could see a threefold increase in the amount of insulin. So there's something about the arrival of foodstuffs from the stomach to the proximal gut that has stimulated a robust pancreatic response. If you do that same study in a patient with type 2 diabetes, you see that that amplitude is significantly diminished. So there's something there that is deficient. And this study goes back 30 years to the 1980s. But it wasn't until about 8 or 9 years ago that we had the first of the drugs that actually target this. But this pretty clearly depicts the fact that patients with type 2 diabetes are deficient within this incretin system. So what do these hormones do? First and foremost, they're going to stimulate the beta cells to release insulin. But at the same time, there's also a compensatory suppression of glucagon from the alpha cells. So right off the bat, you're getting two of those eight factors from the ominous octet. If you increase insulin production, obviously lowers blood sugars, facilitates glucose uptake. If you suppress glucagon, you're going to shut down gluconeogenesis, all of which leads to improved blood sugars. So this is my own depiction of that. Food arrives, and the gut releases GIP and GLP, carries out its effects. Dipeptidyl peptidase 4 is the enzyme that's going to rapidly degrade these two hormones. So when you give a patient a DPP-4 inhibitor, what you're hoping for is that those levels of GLP and GIP, which are low in patients with diabetes, can linger longer to have a more sustained effect. That is very different than what you achieve by giving a peptide agonist, which is what happens when you give a GLP-1 receptor agonist. So you're bypassing the enzymatic breakdown so you can achieve a much more substantial effect, albeit with a lot more side effects. And you can see that within the GLP class, this is getting busy. We had Byetta, that begat Victoza, then we had Bydureon, then we had Tanzium, or at least for another few months anyway, and then Trulicity, and then Lixuma. And not to pick on DPP-4 inhibitors, but we also know and recognize that the DPP-4 market is huge. And they're easy to prescribe, they're very well tolerated, and they certainly work. The point of this slide is to highlight that it's not the same thing as giving the GLP-1 receptor agonist. It just so happens that exenatide, liraglutide, albiglutide, and dulaglutide all did head-to-head studies against sitagliptin, and I don't mean to pick on sitagliptin, primary care's favorite drug, but you could see here that the GLP receptor agonist, regardless of the population being studied, has a much more substantial reduction in A1C. There are some subtle differences. If you're not familiar with this class, they're not necessarily all interchangeable. Byetta was our first available in two doses, a 5 and a 10, had to be dosed twice a day, had to be dosed with a meal, and had a very high incidence of gastrointestinal side effects. Most, if not all, of the glucose improvements were seen postprandially, so it had a very short duration of action. Specifically, exenatide in that form has not been done any studies for cardiovascular benefit. Bydureon, same molecule, but now modified so that it can be dosed once weekly. And an interesting thing happened. When they changed the formulation and they changed the kinetics, What they found in that head-to-head study was that patients on the weekly exenatide seemed to have more fasting glucose reduction, which probably speaks more to the sustained glucagon suppression. There was still some postprandial glucose reduction, but not necessarily as much as what was seen with exenatide. The other thing they noticed was patients on a weekly had less gastrointestinal side effects, which is a benefit to your patients. Recently completed and about to be published, if not published, is the Excel study, which was a cardiovascular outcome-driven study, which unfortunately did not show any primary prevention with the use of exenatide versus placebo in a population of patients with uncontrolled diabetes. Liraglutide, for the purposes of diabetes, we call it Victoza. Your two effective doses, you see there, 1.2 and 1.8. The advantage there is that it can be dialed on the same device. As a daily dose, it's again seems to have a little bit more towards the postprandial, but still has some of the fasting reduction. Similar gastrointestinal, and we're going to show you the cardiovascular studies. Tanzium is included for complete lists, although within months you probably will not be able to get it for your patients. Another weekly option, two doses that you see there. One of the advantages for your patients with Tanzium is that it seemed to have the least gastrointestinal side effects. So it's a very well-tolerated medication for patients who might have struggled to tolerate some of the other drugs in class. Dulaglutide is available as a weekly injection, two different doses. And you could see, again, very strong fasting and postprandial glucose reduction, similar gastrointestinal side effects to other drugs in class, ongoing cardiovascular data. And Lixuma is the latest. This is lixizenatide, two doses that are available. It is only available as a daily dose, and as such, really has primarily postprandial glucose reduction. Also completed a cardiovascular outcome study, which did not yield any improvement over placebo. So quickly, we'll highlight LEADER, which is the liraglutide effect and action in diabetes, evaluation of cardiovascular outcome results. These are all patients with type 2 diabetes, A1C that's uncontrolled, and either age greater than 50 with established cardiovascular disease, or CKD3, or New York Heart Association class 3 or 4 heart failure. Or a patient could be enrolled if they were greater than 60 with cardiovascular risk, either documented albuminuria, increased ABI, hypertension with LVH, or evidence for heart dysfunction. Similar primary outcome looking at death from cardiovascular causes, non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke, about 10,000 patients and an almost four-year follow-up. And you can see at the top the primary composite outcome, p-value of 0.01. This is, again, another medication that is seeming to demonstrate a positive cardiovascular outcome in your patients with type 2 diabetes. And not all of these patients necessarily had established cardiovascular disease. If you look down further, death from all causes, death from cardiovascular cause, death from causes, you see differences there. Myocardial, either fatal, non-fatal MI, did not meet statistical significance. Stroke data did not meet statistical significance. For the nephrologist in the room, you do see that there's a significant reduction in microvascular disease defined as diabetic nephropathy in this study. This probably doesn't project as well, but these are your Kaplan-Meier curves, liraglutide showing the favorability, basically just reproduces what we showed you on the last slide. And I'm going to finish the talk by just a brief transition into basal insulin, because there have been some new advances, new introductions within or just in insulin in general. But I also find it interesting that we tend to position insulin as the last resort when nothing else works. And here's some data that looks at GLP-1 agonist therapy in a study head-to-head against insulin glargine. Now you would think, well, if you put somebody on insulin, that's obviously going to be the most potent thing. But you could see here, regardless of the drug, whether it was exenatide, liraglutide, albiglutide, or even dulaglutide, that these agents, whether they're dosed once a week or once a day, can compare very favorably to basal insulin. And a lot of the don't get too caught up in the numbers, because when you're doing diabetes studies, the degree of A1C reduction is primarily dependent upon where you start. So if you enroll patients with A1Cs of 10%+, you're going to see a more robust A1C reduction than if you study patients with an A1C of 7.8%, for example. But if you look at glargine, which is depicted here in the blue, relative to the comparator in the red or the green, you could see that, again, It's at least very comparable, if not in many cases favoring the GLPs. What can be of particular benefit for your patients, and this gets back to the discussion earlier that we really for years didn't have a lot to offer patients who are obese, but the big difference between offering a patient an insulin glargine versus a GLP is the potential for weight loss. So starting at the left, looking at exenatide, while you might get similar A1C reduction, patients who received exenatide lost about 6 pounds, whereas those who received insulin glargine gained about 3 pounds. It's even more pronounced with liraglutide. In that study, the glargine-treated group gained over 6 pounds. The liraglutide-treated group lost about 7.5 pounds. You're talking almost, 14 pounds difference. So next time you have that patient with type 2 diabetes that's struggling to meet their goals, that's frustrated with their weight, imagine how happy they would be 6 months from now if their A1C is 1.5% better and they're 15 pounds lighter. They're going to think the world of you, and the next time the top doc list comes out, you're probably going to the top of that list. One of the newer concepts that's been introduced with the 2017 update is this idea of combination injectable. And again, it's designed to move us away from the insulin as the last resort. There is a role to combine basal insulin with a GLP-1 receptor agonist in either sequence that you see fit for your patients. You know, it used to be that if a patient with type 2 diabetes started insulin, then you stopped every other medication that they were on and they just took insulin. But in many situations, there can be complementary benefits. You know, if you go back a couple of slides where I showed you the differences with how a lot of the GLPs work relative to blood sugars, you could certainly talk yourself into a situation where you use a basal insulin to get the fasting blood sugars down, and you might consider a GLP to really help lower postprandial blood sugars. And that's really what's depicted here. Although, in fairness, as the disease progresses, a lot of times, even the GLP is not going to get the job done, the SGLT2 is not going to get the job done, and you get to a point where you're intensifying insulin therapy, and that's what is laid out here on this slide. And similar to your GLP class, you can see that there's a lot of new options with insulin. I'll also highlight at the bottom left, that doesn't look like an injection, it's not. That's Afrezza, that's inhaled insulin. So basal insulins, most of you are familiar with the majority of this list. A couple of newer ones to point out would be Toujeo and Tresiba, and probably Basaglar too. The old standbys are at the top, Detemir and Glargine. You can see slight differences in terms of the duration as well as the half-life, as well as the availability, because I think that's important too. Two new concentrated insulins have hit the market in the last couple of years. The first was insulin glargine U300, which goes by the trade name Toujeo. And it's only available in a pen, which is nice for you because you don't have to do any calculation. It's even nicer for your patients so they don't have to get confused. So when they dial up their pen and they dial 30 units, they're going to get 30 units, even though it's only the volume of 10 of insulin glargine. What was interesting is as they concentrated the glargine, it changed the dynamics somewhat. So the duration seemed to extend out a little bit longer, and it changed the half-life a little bit. And what that did was that resulted in more consistent insulin levels from day to day. And more consistent insulin levels should lend itself to more consistent blood sugar levels in your patients. Basaglar is just a modified glargine that comes under a new pharmaceutical company. It's essentially the same product as Lantus, with very, very little difference there. Degludec is a unique basal insulin in that it has a 42-hour half-life. I'm sorry, a 42-hour duration with a 25-hour half-life. And for those of us, when we first heard about this, we said, well, how's that going to work? If you're taking it every 24 hours and it's in your system for 42 hours, eventually it's going to stack and cause problems. It doesn't. And that has to do with the half-life. Half-life is defined as the quantity in is equal to the quantity out. So when taken consistently, it leads to a consistent insulin level every 24 to 25 hours. Also gives the opportunity in a U200 concentration. Again, only available in a pen, so no math necessary. If a patient takes 80 units of Tresiba U200 and they come into your hospital, they get 80 units of whatever your favorite basal insulin is. No dose corrections necessary there. What's nice there is that it's still in a 3 ml pen, so patients can give up to 160 units at one dose, and one pen now holds 600 units of insulin, whereas the U100 pens all hold 300 units of insulin. Most of you know about the short-acting insulins. I included just to highlight Afrezza, because there's probably a lot of people in this room that are either unfamiliar or have no experience using it. And it is an option. It is a very rapid-acting form of human insulin. Because it's inhaled, it gets onset almost immediately. You could see the peak there is about an hour later, and it's fairly rapidly cleared from your system. Contraindication, shouldn't take it if you're a smoker, can't take it if you have a history of asthma or COPD. But we know that there are a lot of patients who are fearful of injections. Even if you can get them over the hump to buy one shot, even if it, you know, you can stretch them to do two shots, the idea of doing four shots a day is overwhelming to patients. The idea of having to bring insulin to a restaurant, having to bring their insulin to work. And what does that lead to? It leads to a lot of noncompliance. You know, if you take the time and ask patients, you know, about their compliance taking insulin, there a lot of them that are on multiple daily injections simply aren't doing it. So this is an alternative. If a patient needs mealtime insulin and they're either struggling with compliance or you know that they're not taking it, this is also an opportunity for you.